Even a small star shines in the darkness for someone somewhere to see. It lights the way for those in the distance. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Our opening quote was from A Small Star by Joyce Johnson Rouse. Today, we'll be talking about the very smallest of stars, so small that they don't quite count as living stars at all, but rather as failed stars that never had enough mass to ignite stellar fires. These objects straddle the boundary between large planets and small stars, allowing us to learn all sorts of interesting things about both categories. In particular, their cool temperatures allow them to exhibit very interesting and complex chemistries. Along with all their fascinating features, they are also essential in astronomy because they are incredibly numerous, and some are, as we've learned recently, among our nearest neighbors. To tell us a little bit about these objects, which are called brown dwarfs, our guest today is Dr. Adam Burgasser from the Center for Astrophysics and Space Sciences at the University of California. Enjoy the interview by Raymond Francis.
Good afternoon and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So you've given a talk just this morning here at the university about brown dwarfs.
Yep.
So maybe just a quick introduction is in order. What are those objects?
So I like to think of them as the objects that straddle stars and planets, giant planets. And they probably form like stars, but for whatever reason they have very low masses. And as a result, they don't get hot enough in their cores to fuse hydrogen. And that's the main energy source for stars. And so at some level, they don't behave like stars. So we classify them as something else. We classify them as brown dwarfs.
Okay, so how do they behave?
Well, they form, and they form relatively warm, about the temperature of about 3,000 Kelvin at their surface. But because they don't have energy generation in their cores, they just radiate all that heat away. So over many billions of years, they get colder and colder, all the way down to the point where you have room temperature brown dwarfs.
So they cool off the way planets do because they don't generate new energy internally.
Well, so planets are funny because you can get some radiation from the sun or the whatever star they're orbiting. So Jupiter is going to stay at about 125 Kelvin for as long as the sun is around. And then some terrestrial planets like Earth are heated not just from the sun, but also from their interiors from radioactive heating. And so they actually do have some either internal or external source of energy. These objects don't have any source of energy, so they just cool off.
And are they typically found alone or paired with real stars, if you will? Or?
So we find them in all combinations. Sometimes we find them just by themselves. Sometimes we find them in pairs. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we find them as companions to other stars. We find them in clusters of stars. We find them immediately in the vicinity of the sun. We find them very far away from the sun. We find them as halo stars. They really are in every environment where you might find a star.
Is this to say that they're very numerous?
Yeah, so we're still trying to pin down the exact number, but just based on the number of brown dwarfs we have in the immediate vicinity of the sun, it looks like they may be somewhere between 20% and 50% of all of the stars in the galaxy are these brown dwarfs.
But we're not going to see them when we look up at night.
No, because they are so faint and they get so cold that most of their light comes out at wavelengths that we can't see with our eyes. And so we actually need special instrumentation, infrared instrumentation, to find these things.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in your talk this morning that they had been implicated as a possible source of additional mass to explain the behavior of the galaxy.
Yeah, so the idea of brown dwarfs really came out in the 1960s. It's essentially a theoretical prediction of what would happen if you have a star that's very, very low mass. And if you think about it, if these are things that have mass, and because they get cold and they get dark, dark. So that kind of sounds like dark mass. So that people thought that if you have enough of these objects, these brown dwarfs, there may be enough of them to actually account for this missing dark matter in the galaxy. And part of the motivation for that is that at the time, when you looked and counted the number of stars as a function of mass, and you could do this today, you find that there are a lot more very low-mass stars than there are solar-type stars or even more massive stars. And so if you just take that relation and you extrapolate it down to its, say, Jupiter mass, you would have all the mass you need to make up dark matter. So it didn't seem like a great leap of faith to make this extrapolation and assume that maybe these brown dwarfs were dark matter.
So based on how many stars of how much mass there is, you would have expected a whole lot of low-mass objects out there.
Yeah, so something like 300 brown dwarfs for every star would be the prediction if you took this Salpeter relation and you extrapolated it down to a Jupiter mass.
Okay, and did that work out? Is that what we find?
Well, by now you would have heard about that as a Nobel Prize, so that didn't work out. It turned out that, as happens in many cases, if you extrapolate a line beyond where you've made the measurement, it actually doesn't really apply. And so it turns out that right around half a solar mass, a third of a solar mass, that line turns over, and so you end up getting a lot fewer of these low-mass stars and brown dwarfs than you would expect from this relation.
So it's not a simple relation, then, the distribution of objects in mass and number.
Yeah.
So any guesses as to why that is, do we know?
There are a lot of theories about that. I mean, this function that we're describing is the initial mass function, and that's one of the predictive quantities that star formation theories try to come up with. And, you know, the main idea is that essentially you get beyond a certain mass, you have to have very dense gas to make these very small stars, and it's much less efficient. You end up just making bigger stars because you have all that gas. And so there's sort of a characteristic mass that giant molecular clouds in the galaxy like to make, and that characteristic mass is much more massive than a brown dwarf. And so the numbers start to drop off right at that characteristic mass, which again is about a quarter of a third of a solar mass.
Okay, so not enough of them to explain dark matter, but enough of them to be very interesting, at least.
Right, yeah, so they're not even close to the number you need for dark matter. I think the mass of all the brown dwarfs in the galaxy might be something like a 20th of the mass of the stars, and what you really need is something like 8 times the mass of the stars. So, but you're still talking about a population that is, you know, half or as numerous as stars in the galaxy, and these are objects that we're just finding now for the first time.
And you're saying there's some even fairly close to our local vicinity.
Yeah, in fact, just last week, there was an announcement of discovery of a pair of brown dwarfs that's only 2 parsecs from the sun. That would make it the third closest star system to our sun. And that was found literally just a couple weeks ago. So
what is that, 6 or 7 light years?
Yeah, about 6 light years away.
Okay, so which is actually quite close. The closest star is only 4 or so.
Right, yeah. So that emphasizes that these things are out there, and they are, you know, they're probably pretty abundant. But they're hard to find because they're very, very low mass and very low temperature and very low luminosity.
There are several different classes of brown dwarfs, you were saying, types of brown dwarfs.
Yeah, so just like stars, we classify brown dwarfs based on their spectral appearance, so the pattern of lines and absorption bands that we see in their spectrum and the overall shape of their spectrum. And the new classes that have been found are labeled L dwarfs, T dwarfs, and Y dwarfs, so that seems like random letters. But but there is actually a reason for choosing those letters, and we have these new classes because when you look at the spectra of these new objects, they are very distinct from the other types of stars that we have in our galaxy. And so, for example, the L dwarfs have very strong absorption from metal hydrides and not a lot of metal oxide absorption, which is what would characterize an M dwarf. So it's a different spectrum, so we characterize it, classify it differently.
Based on the chemistry of its atmosphere or its...
Yeah, so we think that the change in spectral patterns comes from the chemistry, but ultimately the classification is just an observation. We just look at the spectrum and we say, does this look different than anything we've seen before? And if so, that's a new spectral class.
Okay, so a bit like how in biology we start with species based on their appearance, and later we get to the genetics and make the final...
Exactly, because the idea is that what the object looks like is not something that changes. It's an observation. It's a fact. What we understand about why it looks that way can change with time. So, you know, one of the reasons that our spectral sequence seems like a random string of letters, O, B, A, F, G, K, M, L, T, Y,
Yeah, that doesn't seem...
Doesn't sound like...
That's very apparent, yeah.
Is originally the pattern that was observed was ordered in a normal sequence, and then later on we realized that that sequence was out of order if we wanted to rate things by temperature.
Okay.
So we actually did have A, B, C, D, E, F, G all the way down to O, and then it got rearranged when it was realized the physics of the object actually dictated a different order. But the actual, you know, properties or appearance of the star doesn't change. That's what it is. So that's one reason why the classification is a powerful technique, because you don't have to change that classification when you've learned new physics.
Which is helpful.
Which is helpful to so that we can continue talking about the same objects. And when I talk about an L dwarf, everyone else who works in L dwarfs knows what I'm talking about. If I just suddenly call it something else, then that's a lot of confusion.
Even if their relationship to other objects may change as our understanding grows.
Even if that relationship changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So among these brown dwarfs, there's quite a spread in their behavior, I guess.
Yeah, so one of the interesting differences between how we classify or maybe the interpretation of the classifications of brown dwarfs and that between stars is when you have a star that's, say, a G-type star like our sun, almost all G-type stars have basically the same mass as every other G-type star. The spectrum is actually a characteristic of the mass of the object. Right? It comes from the temperature, but the temperature is based on the mass of the star. For a brown dwarf, because it cools over time, an object of a given mass, let's say 5% of a solar mass, will actually change its spectral type over time. And so you'll start off as an M dwarf early on, but it'll eventually get cold enough to start taking on the spectral appearance of an L dwarf, and then eventually it'll take on the spectral appearance of a T dwarf, and then it'll take a spectral appearance of a Y dwarf if you wait long enough.
So this is a life cycle then?
It's a life cycle. And historically, the interesting thing is that the main sequence of stars that we just talked about, OBA, FG, KM, used to be thought of as a life sequence for stars as well, when we didn't understand what the energy source for a star was. And so the idea was that you did start with a big O star, and it cooled off to become a B, and then an A, and then an F, and then a G. And that sequence we still refer to as early type to late type classifications.
Okay.
And that's a leftover of sort of our misunderstanding of the physics. Mm-hmm. But here again, they still look like those stars. So even if our physics has changed, that's still what the properties of stars are.
Okay. But the brown dwarfs themselves do pass from one type to another as they age.
They do, yeah. Yeah.
And so how do they change? What looks different about the cooler brown dwarfs than the brighter ones?
Well, so it's the spectrum that changes, and that spectrum changes because the chemistry in the atmosphere evolves as the temperature gets lower. So, you know, a good example is when you go from an L dwarf to a T dwarf, the main thing that changes about the spectrum is the emergence of methane, methane absorption features in the spectrum, which means there's now methane in the atmosphere. And we know methane cannot form in atmospheres that are warmer than, say, about 1300 Kelvin. And so as the brown dwarf cools, it hits this sort of threshold temperature, and chemistry takes over, and it converts all of the carbon monoxide, or a good fraction of carbon monoxide, into methane. So you change one molecule into another, and you rearrange these molecules, and that changes the spectral appearance, because now you have new absorbers in the spectrum. And so the main thing is, as these objects cool, the chemistry in the atmosphere changes, and hence their spectral appearance changes.
Well, that's interesting. So you could imagine that there would even be a feedback on the temperature and the cooling from...
There may be, yeah. I mean, so, you learn from your basic chemistry class that there are, you know, heats of melting and heats of freezing and stuff like that. So there may be some thermodynamic interaction between what kind of species you have in the atmosphere and what sort of feedback of heating you have in the atmosphere. Now, that's probably not a big effect, because one thing to keep in mind, that the atmospheres of these objects are almost entirely hydrogen helium.
Right.
And so when we talk about the importance of methane and water, it's because they're very strong absorbing features, but they're not necessarily the most abundant molecules in the atmosphere.
Still a small fraction by mass.
Still a very small fraction by mass, yeah.
And how cool is cool, and how far are they cooling in the atmospheres to start condensing these kinds of molecules?
Well, so the first thing to condense out of the atmospheres of brown dwarfs are minerals and metals.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if you think here on Earth, if you want to make a steel girder or something like that, you need a really hot facility to melt the underlying materials, to melt the minerals and the metals. And we're going from the opposite direction. We're going from a place where it's very, very hot and everything is vaporized until we cross that threshold where that's the first stuff that starts to actually condense out. We call those refractory species because they're the hardest to melt, but they're also the first to essentially freeze out when the atmosphere is starting to cool. So right in the sort of right around the Eldorf regime, we start to see evidence of these solid particles of literally rocks, right? So things like ensatite and perovskite and stuff you might pick up on the ground is literally condensing out and forming in the atmospheres of these cool ground dwarfs.
So actual clouds of rock dust or something in the atmosphere.
Yeah, we think it's actually the size of sand grains or silt grains, if you want to be specific. But it's that's sort of the picture that we have for how this condensation takes place.
I'm reminded of descriptions of solar system formation where you talk about how far away from the star things start to condense.
Yeah, like the rock line and the frost line.
Yeah.
So at some level, those lines are also present inside these brown dwarfs, and as they cool, those lines sink inward. So what used to be 1,700 degrees, say, at the surface or at the photosphere, becomes deeper as these objects cool. So, you know, that place, that cloud base of minerals, which we see in the L-dwarfs because it's up in the photosphere, actually sinks below the photosphere in the T-dwarfs. So it's still there, but we can't see it because there's other gases absorbing light at higher levels.
What an exotic environment to think about.
Yeah, quite exotic.
So if they're somewhere between stars and they're somewhere between planets and they have these minerals and strange materials condensing in the atmospheres, is magnetism also something that you find in these kind of objects?
So we do, and this is actually a relatively recent discovery. When we look at, say, slightly hotter stars, the M-dwarfs, which are very low-mass stars, we see lots of evidence of magnetism. We see very strong emission from H-alpha and from X-rays. And then when we look toward the L-dwarfs, we find that those high-energy emissions that wouldn't come from the photosphere disappear. And so for a long time, people thought, well, perhaps those magnetic fields are not working on these very cool brown dwarfs because one of the properties of their interiors is that they're fully convective, right? There's so much opacity in the interior of the object that to get the heat out, it really has to move the heat with the material, so they're fully convective interiors. And it was hard to imagine how you would have something like the sun's magnetic field in an interior which is just fully mixed up.
Right.
Now we know that they definitely have magnetic fields because we see radio emission from a wide variety of these objects. Even going all the way down into the T-dwarf regime, we see radio emission from brown dwarfs. And the only way that radio emission can come about is from some kind of magnetic field, some interaction between electrons and magnetic field lines. And so we now believe that, in fact, these objects have very strong magnetic fields, you know, on order of thousands of Gauss at their surfaces. But they don't show the same signatures that we see in the M-dwarfs because those fields just don't interact with the gas. The gas is so neutral. The magnetic fields basically don't see it. And so you don't get a lot of this high-energy activity, but you still see some of this radio emission that's coming perhaps from the outer parts of the magnetic fields.
So again, a very strange behavior.
A different behavior, yeah. So brown dwarfs are exhibiting different activity than we see with the stars.
So how does better understanding these brown dwarfs help us constrain and refine our understanding of planet formation?
There's two ways of looking at it. One is you think about brown dwarfs as the low-mass end of star formation, and you can ask the question, how low in mass can you go to make a star? You know, we know we can go below the hydrogen burning limit, so that's where we get the brown dwarfs. Can you go even lower mass? Can you go down to, say, 10 Jupiter masses, where these objects would never fuse anything in their interiors? And many people would call those planets. And so planet formation may be just a part of the star formation. Maybe the very low mass end of star formation is actually the formation of things that kind of like planets, where they don't fuse anything. The other side of it is if you think of planets as always forming, say, in disks around stars, there are many models that show that those planets, particularly very early on in the sort of disk evolution, many of those things can be kicked out of the disk, either through instabilities, or just dynamic interactions between the sort of different clumps that form. And you can imagine that if we see a brown dwarf in space, we don't really know where it came from. It's possible that that is something that was kicked out of a planet-forming scenario and is now what we might say free-floating through space. And so both of these populations, if they exist, would overlap in sort of the field population we see in the sky. And, you know, we think a little bit about how you might distinguish those. Perhaps the ones that have been kicked out from the disk might have a different metallicity, a different composition than the ones that form like stars.
Right.
But that requires some pretty careful observations.
Of things that are very cool and
things
very
that are
dim.
Very cool and very dim, yeah.
Well, good luck making those kinds of determinations and better understanding this population of objects.
All right.
Thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
It came out, or at least when I was first aware of it in my undergrad days, you know, it was kind of like, there are planets and there are stars and there are brown dwarfs. And so to kind of find out that there's these three categories of brown dwarfs and then how they kind of vary within those three categories is quite interesting.
Well, I especially think it's interesting how difficult it is to tell these categories apart. So just identifying whether it's a planet or a brown dwarf is almost impossible. And then identifying whether it's a quiet star, a cool star, or a big brown dwarf is also really hard.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a lot of discussion, as it says, depending on whom you ask, where is this line between a planet and a brown dwarf. So it depends, like, you know, some people say 13 Jupiter mass or some people say 15. So it varies, and it's really interesting to see how the chemistry kind of merges, you know, from a planet to these brown dwarfs. And as he said, some of these can actually would have been planets, but they were knocked out or kicked out from their system and now are free-floating brown dwarfs. We never know, you know.
Yeah, that's actually one of the ways that you could theoretically tell them apart, is you could say, well, if it formed in a disk,
yeah,
then it is by definition a planet. But of course, we can't know, mm-hmm, if it formed in a disk or if it formed alone, or we can't know now anyway. So that's one of those ideas. There's another idea that very heavy brown dwarfs could actually be fusing deuterium,
mm-hmm,
and that might be a difference. But of course, we can't peek inside, and not much heat escapes from this process. So again, it's a theoretical thing, and we really can't tell the difference.
But I know, you know, when I was growing up, elementary school age, reading books about stars and planets, you had stars and you had planets. And you had, you know, planets were these little rocky things, or maybe larger sort of gaseous things. But then stars were these much larger, powerful objects with the net energy output. And that was sort of the division. And we start finding exoplanets, and we start finding that they're very strange and that they fill the whole possible space of variation of planets. And then the brown dwarfs come on stage and they're filling that all the adjacent space of that between the planets and the stars. And it looks like just about every possible thing you could imagine to assemble.
Yeah, basically every size there is something there.
Yeah.
And statistically, you would expect that, right?
Of course.
I mean, it makes sense.
Well, but they do form in slightly different ways, potentially. So,
yeah.
So there wouldn't have to be an overlap, but it works out that there is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to see that actually they make up 20 to 50% of our galaxy, and we hardly really know about them, right? You know, we know about the big stars, and we know about the black holes, and all the other stuff we need to know in the galaxy, but these are the main, I would say, component. If that encompasses 50% of the galaxy, we really need to understand these stars, or brown dwarfs, to actually get the whole spectrum of what's actually there in the galaxy.
Yeah, and at that much, I'm not sure whether I should be disappointed or not, that this is not enough to account for dark matter.
Well, remember, he said, yeah, because
they're
said
pretty
20,
small
50% of stars, right?
Not, yeah, but not mass.
50% of the mass.
Yeah.
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 Because how much did you say the mass was? Like,
it was 1/20th the mass,
yeah,
of the stars. So
yeah,
that's not
nowhere near
a lot.
Enough.
They're just too small.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
But you know, that means, of course, that now we still have to solve the dark matter problem. Right? We
yeah.
Can't just
figure it out. No, this stupid problem won't go away.
Yeah. And
really hate having interesting questions in science.
Well, but it's like that curse about living in interesting times.
Yeah.
Like the model of physics is really not complete.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, you know, we have to live in this universe. But on the other hand, we do get to live in a universe where there are objects with, like, mineral clouds condensing in them. which is also fun.
Yeah, they're
that
pretty bizarre
really
places.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
He was talking about how you can get these kind of clouds of rock and metals and stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't really think about it, like he was saying, you know, when they're the first to condense out, because that's their freezing temperature is at the about the 1400 degrees.
Yeah, hundreds of Kelvin.
Yeah,
so you mentioned free-floating planets, and the idea, they do contain a substantial amount of heat. So these are actually talked about as one candidate for a place where there might be life, right? And it's one of the more bizarre candidates that I'm aware of, and I don't know if there's a heavy amount of research, but there is some. People have talked about it. So bizarre places, but again, a place where there is some heat, you know, it is kind of like a planet in some ways. So there is the potential. It's an interesting thing to look for. So
some really strange chemoautotrophy where you've got a source of energy and you've got different layers.
Some sort of weird cloud living thing too, right? So
yeah.
You know, of course, for life to develop and evolve, you're hoping that it's stable on very long timescales, right?
Yeah.
You need an environment that lasts long enough for that to start, however that...
Yeah, well, these places do take a very, very long time to cool down.
Yeah.
So they could be stable enough. Of course, if you wanted to live in the atmosphere, you'd have to survive the winds, which is why we think there isn't life in the Jovian planet's atmospheres. But...
Too much turbulence?
So the winds carry you up into the freezing cold, or down into the extra heat, and would destroy any forming
life.
Oh,
there's too much cycling between layers.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I always thought that was a really cool idea, that we could find some sort of gas bag life or something floating in the atmosphere of a Jovian planet, or maybe even in a brown dwarf.
Yeah, it's a remarkable idea. In any case, you know, we still have these objects which are so cool compared to stars, but so warm compared to planets, and they're just sort of lightly glowing like embers up there, just waiting to be found, and putting out so little radiation because they're cooling so slowly and they're already so at low temperature, they're so hard to find.
Yeah. And they're so dim that they could even be our next door neighbor, we wouldn't know, right? As you mentioned, the recent discovery of the third closest star to us is a binary of brown dwarfs. I mean, that's crazy. So there could be cooler ones out there that are even closer. It could be that our next door neighbor is actually a brown dwarf, and we still don't even know about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting how these planets are cold, and it's like harder to find than you would, you know, go find a star next to you. So doing, you know, studying these objects is way harder compared to just, you know, getting a star, taking a spectrum, analyzing its atmosphere or things it's made of. So, I mean, trying to find one next door can be hard, but...
You'd think it wouldn't be, but it
yeah.
is.
I wonder if the upcoming Gaia mission, which is only months away from launch, I think. It's late this year or next year, or early next year.
Yeah, so that's one of the missions that would have a good chance of spotting some very interesting things like this.
Yeah, I mean, is it... You know, it's very, very sensitive in terms of angular position, but does it have the like the brightness sensitivity to pick up very dim objects?
Well, so I think so.
Yeah.
But also, that pair of our third nearest neighbor, or whatever, that was found because it was moving across the sky.
Yeah.
So it wasn't terribly bright.
Yeah,
it was not noticeable against the background stars, but it was noticed because it was moving.
Right. Yeah, and this is exactly what Gaia is supposed to do, is give proper motion and position very finely. So, yeah, perhaps we'll find a whole squadron of these things just all over the sky.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, Dave Kirsch, and Parshadi Patel. Our editors were Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.